ghosts of past violence and tragedy. You can imagine our shock, then, when we came around one bend in the bumpy road to find ourselves faced with a couple of very well-tended cornfields on our left and some cow pastures with newly strung wire fences on our right. Most surprising of all was the sight between the cornfields of a small but pleasant-looking little house, its clapboards bearing a fresh coat of white paint and its neatly clipped lawn bordered by pretty little flower patches. We turned up the short drive to the house, seeing no sign of life at first, but then finally spying a man in overalls walking from the house to a large green barn what was hidden behind one of the cornfields. He looked to be about 45 or so, and seemed a decent, friendly enough type. As he spread chicken feed from a bucket around to a group of hens what were clucking in the barnyard, he made some pleasant, maybe even affectionate little noises, smiling as he watched the birds scurry around to peck at the food. Watching him, I pulled the surrey to a stop in front of the house. "We're in the wrong place," was all I could say. Miss Howard just studied the scene for a few minutes, looking troubled. Then she got down off the buckboard and moved up to a gate in the white picket fence what bordered the front lawn. "Stay here," she said, passing through the little gate in the fence. El Niño didn't much like the idea of her going to talk to the unknown man in the barnyard by herself, but I told him to just relax, pointing out that she was almost certainly carrying some kind of firearm. All the same, he produced his little bow and one of his short arrows from inside his dinner jacket. He'd rigged the lining of the garment to accommodate his weapons, and kept a steady eye on what went on across the yard. "Excuse me," Miss Howard called as she reached the corner of the house. At the sound, the man turned and, smiling pleasantly, trotted on over to where she was standing, which was just within earshot of the rest of us. "Hello," he said, setting his bucket down and wiping his hands on his overalls. "Something I can do for you?" Looking past Miss Howard, he caught sight of the rest of us in the surrey, and though I don't think the sight of two black men made him feel exactly easy, he didn't seem to get overly nervous about it. "I hope so," Miss Howard answered. "My name is Sarah Howard. I'm an investigator working with the Saratoga County District Attorney's Office. I'm looking for Mr. and Mrs. George Franklin." The mention of the Saratoga DA also didn't seem to rattle the man as much as it should have, certainly not as much as it had the other people we'd visited in the area. The fellow's eyes grew puzzled, but he didn't lose his smile completely. "They're my folks," he said. "Or were. My father died 5 years ago."
"Oh," Miss Howard answered. "I am sorry. And your mother?"
"Over in Hoosick Falls, visiting my brother and his wife," the man answered. "They've got a store there. She won't be back till tomorrow afternoon, I'm afraid. What's this all about?" Matching the man's pleasant tone, Miss Howard asked, "Would you be George Franklin, then, or Elijah?" The man cocked his head in surprise. "Looks like you know all about us, miss. I'm Eli, that's what I'm called. Is there something wrong?" Miss Howard glanced back to the rest of us, looking like she wasn't quite sure how to proceed.
"Mr. Franklin, if I may ask, have you had any communication from your sister recently?"
"Libby?" For the first time, a cloud seemed to pass over Eli Franklin's features, and he glanced at the ground uneasily. "No. No, we haven't any of us heard from Libby for, well, for quite a few years now." When he looked up again, the fellow wasn't smiling anymore. "She in some kind of trouble?"
"I'd really rather discuss the matter when your mother's here," Miss Howard answered.
"Look," Franklin said, "if there's something my mother needs to hear, I think you'd better let me be the one to tell her. What's Libby done?"
"You assume she's done something?" Miss Howard asked curiously. "Why not that something's been done to her?"
Franklin's eyes got wider with surprise as he considered this possibility. "Has something happened to her? Is she all right?"
"Mr. Franklin..."
Miss Howard folded her arms, her green eyes focusing right in on the man's brown ones.
"I'm afraid I have to tell you that your sister is right now on trial in Ballston Spa on a very serious charge."
Franklin absorbed this news, what should have been pretty rattling, with much less alarm than I would have thought possible. So, he said after a few silent minutes. So that's it. His voice wasn't outraged or even stunned. Just sort of, well, sad was the only way to put it. What happened? There's a man mixed up in it, I guess. Is he married, something like that?
Something like that. Miss Howard lied, coolly, figuring, I knew, that she was likely to get more information out of the farmer if she went along with his assumptions instead of telling him the truth.
Why, was she ever in that sort of trouble before?
Libby? Franklin grunted. When it came to men, Libby was always in trouble. Looking away and making a little hissing sound of disappointment, Franklin said, So why are you here? Are we going to be called into court? I don't see why.
No, Miss Howard answered quickly. Nothing like that. I just thought that perhaps you and your family could provide us with some information about your sister's past. She's rather reluctant to talk about it herself.
Franklin shook his head. Nothing surprising in that, I'm afraid, he said. Well, you probably should wait for my mother, if that's the kind of thing you want. She'll know more than I can remember. You could come back tomorrow.
Oh, we'll come back, Miss Howard answered quickly. But if you could just tell me a few basic facts.
She turned to walk across the lawn toward the door of the little house.
Have you always lived here?
Yes, Franklin answered. Then he caught himself. I'm sorry, can I get you anything? Something to drink, maybe, or...
Yes, that'd be very nice of you, Miss Howard said. I'm afraid it's been a long, dusty drive.
And your people there? Franklin said, indicating the surrey.
Hmm?
Miss Howard noised.
Oh, no, I wouldn't worry about them. I won't be long anyway. I'll save most of my questions for tomorrow when your mother's here.
Well, then, please come inside, Franklin said. Giving us a quick glance and a nod, what said to stay put, Miss Howard vanished into the little house, her host scraping the mud and manure off his boots on an old mother's helper what was bolted to the stone steps outside the door.
I don't get it, I said as they went in. This was where Libby Hatch grew up?
Doesn't quite seem to match, does it? Cyrus answered as he got down off the surrey to stretch his legs. But there's never any way of knowing.
Señorito Stevie,
El Niño said to me, moving to put his bow away.
This man, he will not hurt the lady?
I don't think so, I answered, scratching my head.
So,
the aborigine said with a nod, lying down on the back seat of the surrey.
Then El Niño will sleep.
Before closing his eyes, though, he picked his head up to look at me one more time.
Señorito Stevie, the path we are taking to Babiana is a strange one, yes? Or is it only that El Niño does not understand?
No, you understand all right, I told him, lighting up a smoke. One strange path is the truth. Chapter 49. Miss Howard wound up spending just half an hour inside the Franklin place, but it was long enough to learn a few interesting little nuggets of information, ones she refused to tell the rest of us in the surrey until we'd gotten back to Mr. Picton's house that evening and had collected around the chalkboard along with the doctor and everyone else. It seemed that the house we'd seen was very old and contained only a few rooms, and out of these just two were for sleeping. The Franklin brothers had shared one of them, while Libby had spent all of her childhood and early adult years sleeping in a small bed in her parents' room. There'd been no dividing curtain or partition of any kind in this chamber, and so for most of her life, Libby had lived with a total lack of privacy, a fact what the doctor considered extremely important. Apparently, both he and Dr. Meyer had done a lot of work concerning children who were almost never out of sight of their parents, and had discovered that such kids developed a whole batch of problems when it came time to deal with the outside world. They were generally short-tempered, viciously sensitive to any kind of criticism, and, as the doctor put it, pathologically afraid of embarrassment, almost to the point of what Dr. Kraft Ebbing has labeled paranoia. And yet, underneath all that, these same types, when grown, could be strangely doubtful about their ability to make their own way in the world.
They generally grew up with a strong need to have people around them, but at the same time, they resented and even hated those people.
We are not speaking of something precisely similar to violent physical or verbal abuse, of course, the doctor explained as he began for the first time to fill in the section of the chalkboard what had been set aside for facts concerning Libby's childhood. But such a lack of privacy can produce many of the same results, primarily the failure of the psyche to develop into a truly unified, integrated, and independent entity. Again, I thought back to Miss Howard's words about Libby's personality being broken at an early age into pieces what she could never reassemble. It's difficult to conceive of, the doctor went on, the stifling horror of being forced to spend every waking and sleeping hour in the intimate, watchful company of some other human being, of rarely, if ever, knowing solitude. Think of the incredible frustration and anger, the sense of complete suffocation. Cyrus finished for the doctor, and I knew he was thinking back to the various babies what Libby had done in through that very method. Precisely, Cyrus, the doctor said, writing the word on the board in big letters and underlining it. Here, indeed, we have the first key that fits both the enigma of Libby's mind and the apparent puzzle of her behavior. Suffocation. But what did it lead to, Sarah, in her early adulthood? Did the brother give you any idea at all?
There was one subject he was willing to discuss, Miss Howard said, primarily, I think, because he didn't want his mother to have to hear about it. It seems that Libby had a lot to do with boys, and from a very early age. She was extremely precocious, romantically and sexually.
Again, it's logical, the doctor said, considering it. Such behavior would of necessity be secret, and therefore private. Yet it reflects her inability, her very frustrating inability, to achieve such privacy and independence on her own. As he scribbled these thoughts, the doctor added, I don't imagine as a result that she was particularly kind to the unsuspecting young men who became involved with her.
No, Miss Howard answered. Quite a heartbreaker would be the most charitable way to put it.
Good, the doctor judged, nodding. Very good.
Mr. Moore, who'd been sitting in the corner with a big glass pitcher full of martinis, what he'd mixed for himself, let out a big groan at that, and the sound seemed to be echoed by the wail of a train whistle off in the distance. Listening to it, Mr. Moore held up a finger.
You hear that, Kreitzler? That's the sound of this damned case getting away from us. It's fading into the night, and what are you doing? Still sitting around with your blasted chalkboard, acting like there's some way you're going to think your way out of losing. We're finished. Who the hell cares why Libby Hatch is the way she is at this point?
The eternal voice of encouragement, Mr. Picton said, glancing over to Mr. Moore. Have 6 or 7 more of those foul concoctions, John, and perhaps you'll nod off. Then we can go on in peace.
I know it seems late in the race, Moore, the doctor said, lighting a cigarette as he studied the blackboard. But we must do what we can while we can. We must.
Why? Mr. Moore grumbled. Nobody wants the damned woman to be guilty. They've made that much clear. Who the hell are we carrying on for at this point?
There's still the problem of Anna Linares, John, Lucius said. Mr. Moore let out another grunt.
A girl whose own father doesn't care if she lives or dies. She'll probably have as good a chance with Libby as she would with him, the Spanish bastard.
I wasn't actually thinking of Anna Linares just now, the doctor said, his voice going very quiet.
No, Miss Howard said. It's Clara, isn't it? How was she? I didn't even think to ask.
The doctor shrugged, looking uneasy. Bewildered, and not very talkative, though I don't blame her for that. I promised her that this ordeal would help both her and her mother. It's done neither, and now her terror at the memory of what happened 3 years ago is being matched by her fear of what will happen if her mother goes free. She's not so young as to be blind to the danger she may be in if Libby is loose to take revenge on what she no doubt sees as a treacherous child who was the only witness to her bloody act.
Setting his piece of chalk down, the doctor picked up a glass of wine
and tried to take a sip, but he stopped in mid-action as if he had no interest in any kind of relief.
"You can't blame yourself, Doctor," Marcus said. "The case looked solid. There was no reason to believe it would go this way."
"Perhaps," the doctor said, sitting down and putting his glass aside.
"And may I remind everyone again," Miss Howard said, but she got only that far before Mr. Moore let out another big groan.
"Yes, yes, we know, Sarah. It's not over yet. My God! Don't you ever get tired of that saw?"
"If you mean, don't I wish it would end, so I'd have a good excuse to sink to the bottom of a glass and live there, John, then no," Miss Howard snapped. "It's true that we may not have gotten very much information today, but the mother must know more, and she returns tomorrow."
"So will we," she looked to the doctor. "Will you come with us? I'm not sure I'll know all the right questions to ask."
From somewhere deep, the doctor managed to stir the final traces of what passed for encouragement.
"Of course," he said, putting his hands on his legs and then standing up. "But now, if you all don't mind, I think I'll retire before dinner. I'm not particularly hungry. We don't need to be at the Franklins until the afternoon, you say, Sarah?"
"That's right."
"Then there's no reason to rise early, at least."
He looked around the room a little awkwardly.
"Good night."
We all mumbled replies, and then grew silent as the doctor slowly climbed the stairs. Once she'd heard his bedroom door close, Miss Howard took a piece of chalk from the board and flung it at Mr. Moore's head, catching him very nicely between the eyes and making him yelp.
"You know, John," she said, "if the Times won't take you back, you could always open a new business, kicking injured dogs or knocking the crutches out from under cripples."
"Some day," Mr. Moore moaned, rubbing the chalk mark on his head, "you're going to do me some serious physical injury, Sarah. And I promise you I'll sue. Look, I'm sorry if you all think I'm being a defeatist, but I just don't see what you're going to find out from Libby Hatch's mother that's going to change things."
"Maybe nothing," Miss Howard shot back, "but you've seen what the doctor's been through this week. And remember, we drew him into this case to help him forget his troubles in New York. Now it looks like we've only made things worse. You might at least try to be encouraging."
Mr. Moore glanced over at the stairway, looking a little ashamed of himself. "Well, I suppose that's true."
He poured himself another drink and then turned to Miss Howard.
"Do you want me to come along tomorrow?"
He did his best to sound sincere.
"I promise you I will try to keep things hopeful."
Miss Howard sighed and shook her head.
"I don't think you could be hopeful right now if your life depended on it. No. It'll be better if just Stevie and I go. The fewer people, the less awkward the silence will be." She looked up at the ceiling. "And I've a feeling there's going to be a lot of silence."
It was a sound prediction.
The doctor didn't come down from his room till close to noon on Sunday, and he still didn't seem to have much of an appetite. He did his level best to take an interest in the job that lay ahead of us, but it was a pretty hopeless cause. He seemed to know just how unlikely it would be that we'd discover anything so crucial at the Franklins' farm that it would swing our fate in court. By the time we climbed aboard the Surrey, he'd dropped any effort at conversation and grown very quiet and thoughtful again. And he stayed that way through all of the long drive over to Scaghtikoke. The Franklin house was just as peaceful as it had been the day before. But this time, in addition to Eli Franklin working around the barnyard, there was an elderly woman, fleshy but not fat, weeding one of the flower patches by the house. Her white-haired head was shielded from the sun by a wide-brimmed straw hat, and her gingham dress was covered by a slightly soiled apron. Even from halfway up the drive, we could hear her singing to herself, and a small dog was happily prancing around, letting out a little yap occasionally to get the woman's attention and receiving a pat on the head and a few kindly words in return. As the doctor took in the scene before him, his black eyes began to glow with a light what I hadn't seen in evidence for a couple of days.
"So,"
he said, as I drew the surrey to a stop beside the gate in the white picket fence. And when he got down to the ground, he smiled just a little.
"Not precisely what you expected?" Miss Howard asked, joining him.
"Tragedy and horror do not always come with the appropriate trappings, Sarah," the doctor answered softly. "If they did, mine would be a useless profession."
As I tied off our horse's reins, I saw that Eli Franklin had caught sight of us and was running out to the gate. He seemed to be moving with real purpose.
"Hello, Miss Howard," he said, his face full of worry.
"Mr. Franklin," she answered with a nod. "This is Dr. Kreitzler, who's also working on the case. And I don't think you met our young associate, Stevie Taggart, yesterday."
Eli Franklin just shook our hands quickly without saying anything, then turned to Miss Howard again. "My mother, when I told her—" But by then the woman who was tending the flowers had turned and seen us. Her little dog was yapping louder and faster as he, too, registered the presence of strangers.
"Oh," the woman called, in a voice what was both very loud and sort of melodious. "Oh, are these Elspeth's friends, Eli, dear?"
She started toward us, and Eli Franklin spoke even faster and with more urgency. I couldn't tell her that Libby was actually in trouble. It would set her nerves off, and her heart's not so strong anymore. Is there any way that you can find out what you need to know without...
"We shall try, Mr. Franklin," the doctor answered good-naturedly. "It may be that your mother can tell us all we need to know without our revealing our true purpose."
Eli Franklin's face filled with relief, and he just had time to say, "Thank you, doctor, I do appreciate—" before his mother arrived at the gate. The little dog was yapping louder than ever, and as Mrs. Franklin held her hat in place on her head, she looked down to scold him gently.
"Leopold, stop that, these are visitors."
The dog tried to calm down, but it was an effort.
"I'm sorry," the woman said to us, her sing-song voice growing a little addled. "He's very protective. Well, so you're all friends of my daughter's. And trying to find her, my son says?"
Back behind her amber-colored eyes, you could see that Mrs. Franklin, who must have been very handsome in her day, didn't quite believe the story, but that it was easier for her to accept it than to contemplate other, less pleasant possibilities.
"I'm afraid we can't help you," she went on, before the doctor or Miss Howard could answer. "As Eli told you yesterday, we haven't heard from Libby in several years. Not that I'm surprised. So careless, that girl. She never could take care of the simplest little—"
"Yes, Mother," Eli Franklin said, touching her elbow to quiet her down. "This is Miss Howard and Dr. Kreitzler, was it? And the boy is called—"
"Just Stevie'll do,"
I said, looking at the woman and getting a big smile in return.
"Oh, just Stevie, eh?" she said, reaching out to touch my cheek. "Well, that's good enough. You're a fine-looking boy."
"They think maybe something we know about her past will help them locate Libby," Eli Franklin went on. Miss Howard nodded. "You see, she hasn't contacted us in quite some time, either. Perhaps if we knew a little more of what her usual habits were—" Mrs. Franklin nodded.
"Hasn't contacted you? Well, that doesn't surprise me, either. I don't know why that girl never could take care of the smallest details. We've gotten one or two little notes over the years, but never so much as a single visit. She just dances through life, doing as she pleases. Oh, well, some people are that way, I suppose."
She pulled the picket gate open.
"Please, please come in and sit on the porch out back. We've screened it in so you won't have to fight off these terrible flies. What with all the moisture this summer, I'm afraid the insects have been positively thriving."
We started to follow her around the side of the house, none of us getting a word in.
"Now, I've made lemonade and iced tea. I thought it would be too warm for anything else. There's some gingerbread, too, and we might find something even sweeter for you, Stevie, if you crave sweets as much as my boys did. But as for Libby, I don't know how much help I can be."
Moving on to the back porch of the house, we found that the big screen panels did in fact remove us from the annoying black flies what had started to swarm in the afternoon sun.
"It may be that you can tell me more, really. As I say, we haven't even seen her in—how long has it been, Eli?"
Eli Franklin looked at Miss Howard, what you might call pointedly.
10 years, he said.
10?
His mother repeated. That can't be right. No, you must be mistaken, Eli. I can't believe that even Libby, careless as she is, would go 10 years without a visit. Has it really been that long? Well, sit down. Sit down, everyone, and have something to drink.
I took a seat in a big wicker chair, sighing a little to myself. Getting information out of this biddy was going to be a job, all right.
Thank you, Mrs. Franklin, the doctor said, taking a seat in another of the wicker chairs. The afternoon is warm, and the drive was a long one.
Yes, Mrs. Franklin answered, pouring out glasses of her cool refreshments and handing them around.
All the way from Boston Spa. I must confess I never would have guessed that Elspeth would be the center of so much attention.
In the words, and also in their tone, there was something what reminded me in a chilling way of the first time we'd ever heard Libby Hatch speak outside her house on Bethune Street.
She was never the kind of girl that people took much interest in.
Eli Franklin shot Miss Howard a quick look again, asking her with his eyes not to bring up the things he'd mentioned the day before.
Her brothers were more outgoing, of course, more social. They got that from me, I suppose. But Elspeth was more like her father, a daydreamer, too busy in her own mind to ever be of much use, really.
I understand. Your husband is no longer with us? Miss Howard said.
No, bless his heart, the woman answered, reaching around from the table to slip sprigs of fresh-cut mint into all our glasses, and then passing around a plate of gingerbread. He's been gone almost 5 years now. Poor George worked himself into the grave, keeping the farm going. He never was much good at it, really, if he hadn't had the boys to help him. But they're born workers, both of them. They get that from me, too, I expect. Practical heads. But George was a dreamer like Elspeth. It was all he could do to raise 3 children and keep this place afloat.
And Elspeth? The doctor asked carefully. Surely she was some help to you?
Mrs. Franklin laughed, the light, well-oiled sound of a woman what was used to handling men.
Well, I don't know how many ways I can say it, doctor, but the girl was never really any good to anyone, not when it came to the practical business of living. Oh, she was pretty enough, and clever, too, especially with her studies, but not useful in any way that would have really been important for a young lady.
I saw Miss Howard near choke on her piece of gingerbread, but she managed to keep a pleasant expression on her face.
A positive fright in the kitchen, Mrs. Franklin went on, and as for housework, well, I couldn't even put her to dusting without her breaking whatever we had that could be broken. A sweet thing, but what does sweetness matter when you're all grown up? It was no wonder she never had any suitors. Lived with us until she was near an old maid, and not one man ever came to ask for her hand. I didn't wonder. Men around here work hard. They need a woman who can tend house, not a clever dreamer. And prettiness fades, doctor. Prettiness fades.
The little dog, who'd followed us onto the porch and was panting in excitement beside Mrs. Franklin's chair, let out another yap.
Oh, Leopold, you want gingerbread. I'm so sorry. Here.
Handing the dog a piece of the cake, which I had to admit was as good as any I'd ever had, Mrs. Franklin began to stroke his head.
Yes, there, my sweet boy. You don't remember Libby, do you, Leopold? She left before you came to live with us.
The woman looked back up, lost in thought.
We had another dog then, Libby's dog. What was his name, Eli?
Fitz,
Eli Franklin answered, munching on his gingerbread and swilling his third glass of lemonade.
Yes, that's right, Fitz. Oh, she loved that dog. Cried awfully when he died. I thought she might expire herself. Remember, Eli?
Suddenly, Eli Franklin stopped chewing. He looked around at all of us, what you might call guardedly, then slowly got the gingerbread in his mouth down his gullet.
No, he answered, quickly and quietly.
Well, of course you do, Mrs. Franklin said. Don't be silly. It was just before she left to work with that family in Stillwater.
The Muhlenbergs? Miss Howard said, hopefully.
Oh, then you know the Muhlenbergs, Miss Howard?
Mrs. Franklin replied, happily surprised.
Fine people, Elspeth said. She wrote from there once. Very fine. And just before she left, she had that attack of bilious fever.
Mother, Eli Franklin said, still looking a little alarmed.
And the morning after that, Fitz died. I'm sure you remember, Eli. We buried him out by the barn. You built a little coffin, and Libby painted a headstone.
Mother,
Eli Franklin said, a little harshly now. Then he smiled around at the rest of us, though it was a strain.
I'm sure these people don't want to hear about every little thing that happened to Libby while she was living here. They're interested in what's happening to her now.
Well, Mrs. Franklin looked at her son in some shock. But along with the shock, there was a trace of sudden, cold anger of the variety what I'd sometimes seen come into Libby Hatch's face.
I certainly apologize if I'm embarrassing my own son. But I was telling them about the Muhlenbergs.
You were telling them...
Eli Franklin said, then, catching his mother's look, he dropped it.
All right. Go ahead, tell them about the Muhlenbergs.
They were very fine people, Mrs. Franklin went on, giving her son one last warning look as her tone became musical again.
That's what she said in her letter, and of course I was glad because it seemed the perfect sort of work for her.
Miss Howard's face near dropped, and I imagine mine did the same. For anybody to say that being a wet nurse was the perfect sort of work for Libby Hatch indicated that they didn't know her at all. And Mrs. Franklin, however addled she might have seemed at moments, did appear to be aware of her daughter's strengths and weaknesses. Before either of us could give voice to our confusion, though, the doctor, suspecting that the story had undergone a change somewhere along the line of communication, asked,
"And what sort of work was that, Mrs. Franklin?"
"Why, don't you know?" she answered, surprised. "Surely, if you know the Muhlenbergs, you know that Libby was their son's tutor. Before she went to New York, that is, but... perhaps you met them after she'd already left."
"Yes," Miss Howard said, quickly and nervously. "Just recently, in fact, and we didn't meet your daughter until she'd arrived in the city. You see, that's where we're all from."
"Oh, is that so?" Mrs. Franklin answered. "Well, if you're from New York, then you certainly know more about my daughter than I do. You see, I've had only one letter from her since she moved there, and that was so long ago. It's been years since I've heard anything at all. But then, as I say, Elspeth was always that way. I doubt she even realizes she hasn't written. So very careless, that girl, always daydreaming about something."
For a moment, Mrs. Franklin's mind seemed to wander in that way we'd already witnessed. But when it did so this time around, I began to see that what I'd taken for addle-headedness was really just a way of avoiding subjects what she wouldn't or couldn't discuss, maybe because they were too painful. Or maybe because they would have revealed things about her what she didn't want known, especially to strangers. Such being the case, I expected the doctor to start pressing harder for information. He wasn't one to let people get away from the point. I was doubly surprised, then, when he just stood up, studied Mrs. Franklin's eyes as they stared into the distance, and finally said, "Yes, I suspect you are right, Mrs. Franklin. Thank you so much for the refreshment. We shall continue to look for your daughter in New York." Snapping out of her seeming daze quickly and looking very relieved, Mrs. Franklin also stood up.
"I am sorry I can't be of more help to you all. Truly I am. And if you do run across Elspeth, you might just tell her that her family's curious to know what she's up to."
With that, she started to walk us toward the screen door.
"Doctor," Miss Howard said, looking concerned, "I'm not sure that we've..."
"Oh, I think Mrs. Franklin's told us all she can," the doctor answered pleasantly, "and it will prove extremely helpful, I'm sure."
As he said these last words, he gave Miss Howard a very meaningful look, and she, taking it on faith that what he said was true, just shrugged and moved to the screen door. As for me, I had no idea what they were talking about. But then I hadn't really expected to. I hadn't even been sure I'd be led into the house, and once I was there, I figured I'd have to wait till the ride home for explanations. As we passed back out onto the lawn from the porch, Mrs. Franklin held up a finger.
"Do you know, Doctor, you might try the theaters. I always had an idea that Elspeth would end up on the stage. I can't imagine why, but I always did. Well, goodbye now. It was so pleasant to talk with you all."
Miss Howard and I tried not to look even more confused as we said goodbye to Mrs. Franklin, who called to her little dog and then vanished into the small house. "I'll see you to your rig," Eli Franklin said, himself looking pretty relieved that we were departing. "And I thank you for not mentioning the matter of Libby's being in trouble to my mother. You see how she is, and—"
"Yes, Mr. Franklin."
The doctor's voice had suddenly lost the soft, polite tone he'd used with the man's mother. "We do indeed, as you say, see how your mother is. Perhaps more than you know. And I'm afraid I shall require a service for concealing our true purpose from her." The words and the way the doctor said them struck new nervousness, maybe even fear, into Eli Franklin.
"Service?" he mumbled.
"What do you—" "The barnyard, Mr. Franklin," the doctor answered. "We should like to inspect the barnyard." "The barnyard?" Franklin tried to muster up a laugh. "Why in the world would you want to see that? There's nothing—" "Mr. Franklin." The doctor's black eyes struck the man's features dead still. "If you please." Franklin started to shake his head slowly, a movement what quickly became agitated. "No. I'm sorry, but I don't even know what you want. I'm not going to let you—"
"Very well."
The doctor turned back toward the porch. "You make it necessary for me to ask your mother." He seized hold of the handle on the door, only to have Franklin grab his forearm with one of his powerful hands, not roughly, but with desperation all the same. "Wait," Franklin said. Then, as the doctor spun a scowl on him again, he released his grip. You just want to look around the barnyard?"
"Mr. Franklin, you know perfectly well what we want to see,"
the doctor answered, and as he did, Miss Howard suddenly clutched at her forehead, apparently realizing whatever it was that the doctor was driving at. Swallowing hard, Franklin looked to her. "Libby's in a lot more trouble than you said she was, isn't she?" "Yes," Miss Howard said. "I'm afraid so." Seeming a little pained by that information, Franklin nodded once or twice. "All right. Come on, then." Leading the way with long, slow steps, Franklin guided us off the back lawn of the house and across the dusty drive, then into the manure and mud-covered barnyard. As he did, Miss Howard and I pulled up close to the doctor. "You suspect—" Miss Howard asked.
"I suspect nothing,"
the doctor finished for her.
"I'm certain. We need only an accurate description of the site to demonstrate to the woman that we have actually been here and are in earnest."
"Description of what site?" said yours truly, now the only member of our group who didn't know what was going on. But Miss Howard and the doctor both kept following Franklin silently around to the far side of the barn. There was a muddy waterhole to one end of the structure, round back, and a large patch of prickly raspberry bushes at the other. Franklin walked over to one section of the raspberries and then, sighing as he looked to us again, grabbed an old branch that had fallen off of a gnarled crabapple tree what stood not far from the waterhole. He used the branch to slash and pry at the thick, thorny stems of the bushes in front of him, and as he did, a small object came into view on the ground. It was a wooden headstone, maybe 2 feet high. The thing was cracked in a few spots, but not badly, and the lettering what had been painted on it, though faded, was easy to read. "Fitz, 1879 to 1887. Love always. From Mama." As I read the last line, I felt as though somebody had run along my back with the hard end of a goose quill. They were the very same words what were carved on Thomas and Matthew Hatch's graves in Ballston Spa. "Sure," I whispered to nobody, taking a couple of frightened steps back as I kept staring at the headstone. "Of course. She was a wet nurse." At the sound of the doctor's voice, I finally looked up.
"What did the dog die of, Mr. Franklin?" he said.
Franklin just shook his head.
"I don't know. She brought him to me, dead.
Not a mark on him. I built her the coffin, and she took it off and sealed it up. Then I helped her bury it."
"And your sister's bilious fever?" the doctor asked.
"It lasted all night," Franklin answered, turning to stare at the headstone. His voice became what you might call detached, as he added, "Came on her after we'd all gone to sleep. Nearly killed her. But do you know, she never said a word until morning. Never made a sound. My mother and father, they slept right through it. Right through it." The doctor nodded.
"You understand, Mr. Franklin, that a person who destroys evidence of a crime can be indicted as an accessory."
Franklin nodded, his face still blank. "It's only a dog." The doctor moved closer to the man.
"I hope, for your sake, that your sister will see reason and make it unnecessary for us to return with a court order authorizing an exhumation of this dog.
In the meantime, I advise you to make very sure that the grave is not tampered with."
Franklin didn't say anything to that, just kept nodding and staring at the headstone. Satisfied that the fellow had gotten his point, the doctor looked to Miss Howard and me, then turned and started back for the surrey.
"Doctor," Franklin mumbled as we went, causing us to stop and turn back to him. "She never... Livy, I mean, she never had much. You heard my mother. She was just a servant in this house. Not even that, a servant gets her own quarters."
He looked down at the grave again.
"She had men, boys really, who chased her. She was foolish. But it was something of her own. She deserved to have that much without it ruining her life. She deserved to have more than just a dog."
The doctor nodded once, and then we kept moving to our rig.
"Do you think," Miss Howard said quietly, "that Judge Brown will give us a court order?"
"It's my belief that such action won't be necessary," the doctor answered. "Darrow and Maxon will be able to see reason, even if Libby can't."
As we climbed up onto the rig, Miss Howard looked back toward the barn.
"And the brother, did he know? Does he know?"
"He suspects, certainly,"
the doctor answered as I started our horse moving.
"But as to whether or not he's sure..."
"What about the mother?" I asked. "She ain't so harebrained as she makes out. She might know, too."
"It's possible, of course," the doctor answered. "She, too, suspects much about her daughter, and wouldn't be altogether surprised by this. But I don't think she's aware of it. A woman like Libby Hatch would have found ways to conceal the pregnancy. And you heard what happened when she finally delivered the child. She never made a sound. In most cases, I wouldn't believe it. But in this instance, we are dealing with a person capable of incredible discipline when she finds herself trapped."
"But who was the father?" Miss Howard asked.
"All questions to be answered later," the doctor replied. "Stevie, I saw an inn on our way through the town. They may have a telephone. We must call Mr. Picton and tell him to meet us at his office as soon as we return. Then he must contact Darrow and Maxon and have them, along with their client, join us at, say..." Pulling out his watch and checking the time, the doctor made a quick calculation. 9 o'clock, yes, that should leave us enough time to work out the details."
Tucking the timepiece away again, the doctor folded his arms anxiously.
"And then, we shall see."
Chapter 50. By 7:30 that evening, our entire team was packed into Mr. Picton's office one more time to weigh the results of our trip to the Franklin's farm and determine what we should do about it all. Even El Nino was present. As usual, it wasn't that he understood most of what was going on or had anything to contribute, but he was always concerned that the lady, Mr. Montrose, Mr. Picton, his future jefe, or one of the rest of us might be set upon by some villainous characters. He'd come to believe that it was his personal mission and responsibility to prevent any such assault. and as those of us who actually had something to say about the case sat in a circle around Mr. Picton's desk, the Aborigine stood by the door, weapons at the ready. At the time, I considered this, like so much of his behavior, amusing and touching, nothing more. Later, I'd come to wish that we'd all followed his cautious lead. The main topic of conversation, a conversation what rapidly turned into a debate, was how we were going to present our discovery to the defense lawyers and what the best deal to try to strike with them in light of it was. The general thought was that Mr. Picton would tell Libby Hatch that the state would be willing to forget about the coffin what was buried behind her family's barn in return for her changing her plea to one of guilty. But guilty of what? Mr. Picton was very reluctant to abandon the first-degree murder charge, what would have sent Libby to the electrical chair. But he knew that giving someone a choice between death now and death later wasn't really much of a carrot. So he tried to reconcile himself to the next best thing, second-degree murder and a sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. Some of our group, Marcus and Mr. Moore mainly, didn't see why Libby'd go for that option either, given her personality. A woman who seemed to enjoy her freedom in as many different ways as this one did wasn't likely to look on the prospect of spending the rest of her days behind bars with much enthusiasm. But the doctor disagreed. He figured that, though the woman might rebel at the idea of such a sentence on the surface, some deeper part of her soul would accept and maybe even welcome it. Mr. Moore and Marcus were skeptical about this thought, too, until the doctor explained it further. Prison, he said, would actually satisfy the conflicting longings of Libby's spirit, the need to be isolated while at the same time having people around. The need to perform what she saw as some sort of useful task, for a woman as clever as Libby would no doubt be assigned to a position of some authority among the prisoners in, say, the women's block at Sing Sing, while at the same time feeling like she was defying accepted social customs and authority. She would, after all, be a jailbird. And then there was the question of her desire to control what went on around her. Many criminals, the doctor said, especially those of Libby's stripe, secretly craved some kind of regulation and discipline in their lives. She had, he reminded us all, been able to go through hours of labor without ever making a sound loud enough to wake her parents. And though physical control in this case would actually be administered by the prison, Libby, with her talent for self-delusion, would quickly convince herself that in fact she was the one who was dictating what went on. And in a way, the doctor said, she'd be right, being as it would be her own criminal actions what would have landed her in jail. But one consideration weighed above all others in convincing the doctor that Libby would take the deal what Mr. Picton planned to offer. Over and over, we'd seen her demonstrate that she prized her own life above all things, including the health and safety of her own offspring. The chance to escape execution would be enough, the doctor said, to make Libby play along, even without the other influences. Marcus was satisfied by this reasoning, but Mr. Moore still had his doubts. And Mr. Picton, though he knew they were taking the only sensible course, continued to feel a little cheated by not being able to secure a death sentence. But the doctor insisted to all of them that the only thing what was truly important was for Libby Hatch to be put into a place where she'd never again have any contact with children, especially her own child. On top of that, knowing that her mother was going to be jailed for life instead of executed would only help Clara Hatch's recovery, since the girl wouldn't have to carry the enormous weight for the rest of her life of having played a part in sending her mother to the chair. Miss Howard stated that this was the best reason of all for making the deal. Indeed, she said, considering what effect her mother's execution might have had on Clara, she wondered why Mr. Picton hadn't made life imprisonment for Libby his goal in the first place. This comment led to some pretty passionate statements from the assistant district attorney about the unknowable future and how he couldn't trust that some governor might not get suckered, say, 20 or 30 years down the line, by one of Libby's effective performances into reversing the part of her sentence what specified that there was to be no parole.
The doctor and Miss Howard might have done a lot that day to explain her evil, he said, but they hadn't done anything to remove it. Only death could provide that kind of solution. That set the doctor off again on the subject of how was science ever supposed to learn anything from criminals like Libby if the state went around frying and hanging them all. And this discussion, along with all the others related to it, went on and on as the sun set beyond the train depot down the hill from Mr. Picton's window. Finally, at a few minutes after 9, there was a knock at the door of Mr. Picton's outer office. El Niño pulled the thing open, and in wandered Mr. Darrow and Mr. Maxson, the first looking curious but confident as he took in the scene around him, the second seeming, as ever, very nervous. With formal little movements, El Niño showed the pair into Mr. Picton's inner office, and we all stood up. "Ah, Maxson, Darrow," Mr. Picton said. "Good of you to come so late on a Sunday evening."
"Quite a conference you've got going here," Mr. Darrow said, glancing around at us all and nodding a polite greeting. "Having trouble planning your summation, Mr. Picton?"
"Summation?" Mr. Picton said, playing at surprise. "Oh, great jumping cats! Do you know, with all that's happened today, I'm afraid I completely forgot about closing arguments. But then I'm not entirely sure we're going to need them." He pulled out his pipe and clamped it between his teeth, looking very pleased with himself. Mr. Maxson, who'd had a lot of run-ins with Mr. Picton in court and was in a position to know when the man was up to something, started to look even more jittery than he had when he came in. "What is it, Picton?" he asked, pushing his pince-nez down tighter on his skinny nose. "What have you got?"
"What can he have?" Mr. Darrow asked with a chuckle. "The state's closed its case in chief, Mr. Picton. I hope you didn't make the mistake of saving anything for last-minute theatricals. Judge Brown doesn't seem like the kind of man that'll go for them."
"I know it," Mr. Picton answered. "And your colleague Maxson there knows I know it. So whatever I've got, it must be something fairly good to warrant my asking you here tonight. Don't you think so, Maxson?" Mr. Maxson, unlike Mr. Darrow, seemed to take this statement straight to heart, and pleased by that fact, Mr. Picton looked over to me. "Stevie, I wonder if you'd just run down and tell Henry to have Mrs. Hatch, I beg your pardon, Mrs. Hunter, brought up from her cell." "Got it," I said, making for the door. As I went out, I heard Mr. Picton continuing, "Doctor, why don't you stay in here with the three of us? The rest of you might just have a seat in the outer office. We don't want to overwhelm the defendant, after all." After bolting down the hall, I dashed onto the marble stairs, taking them two at a time on my way down to the guard station in the entryway. Running to it without looking up, I began to say, "Mr. Picton wants—" Then I saw who I was talking to. It wasn't the guard Henry at all, but one of the other big men what had watched the courtroom doors all through the trial. "Where's Henry?" I asked. The man looked at me with a sour expression. "What's it to you, kid?" I shrugged. "Nothing. But what it is to Mr. Picton is he's got orders for him." Looking even more irritated, the guard nodded toward a doorway behind him. "Henry's downstairs, guarding the prisoner." I heard the statement. I accepted it with a simple nod of my head and never thought twice about it. But now, looking back across the gap of so many years, I find myself once again wishing desperately that something could have made me see what was going on. "Well," I told the guard, "Mr. Picton wants he should bring the prisoner up to his office."
"What now?" the guard asked.
"I don't figure as he meant next Thursday," I said, turning around and heading back to the staircase. "If I was you, I'd get moving. They're all up there waiting."
"Hey," the guard called after me as I started up the stairs. "Just remember, I don't get paid to take orders from any kid."
Then he turned to go through the door behind him.
"He just took one, mug," I mumbled, smiling as I got back to the second floor. "So go chase yourself."
Back in Mr. Picton's outer office, I found that Cyrus, the detective sergeants, Mr. Moore, Miss Howard, and El Niño were all crowded around the closed oak door to the inner chamber. Cyrus had the aborigine up on his shoulders, from which spot El Niño was looking through a partly open transom, spying on what was going on among the three lawyers and the doctor, and trying to whisper his intelligence back to the others. The only problem was that his English wasn't good enough to understand much more than half of what the men inside were saying.
"They are speaking of the girl, Clara, now," El Niño whispered as I came in.
"What about her?" Miss Howard asked.
Something. Something.
El Niño shook his head in frustration.
The Señor Doctor is saying things I do not understand. Some things about sickness and about the mother. She was the killer.
Oh, this is useless, Mr. Moore said in frustration. Then he signaled to me, Stevie, trade places with your friend. I want to know what the hell's happening in there. I was about to follow the order when there came a knock at the outer door. Waiting for El Niño to get down off of Cyrus's shoulders, I opened the thing and found myself facing the guard Henry and Libby Hatch. Better than a week in jail, hadn't done anything to damage the way the woman carried herself. Her black dress looked as crisp as it had on the night she got off the train, or to dull the devilish gleam in her golden eyes. I'd never been so close to those eyes before, nor had them focused directly on me. And I found that their general effect was to cause me to back up, slowly and silently, until I near fell over the unused secretary's desk what sat in that outer office. This reaction caused Libby to smile at me in a way what I hope never to see in another person, a way what brought Mr. Moore's earthy language at the Café Lafayette back into my mind. You really couldn't tell from the look in her face just what this woman might have in store for you. Love, hate, life, death, all of them, it seemed like, were very possible so long as they served her purposes. And from the proud way that she moved through the others to get to the thick door to the inner office, it was pretty clear that Libby Hatch felt like her purposes were being very well served just at that juncture. She glanced at each of the silent faces before her and kept smiling, then started to shake her head as if to say that we'd all been terribly foolish to even think about taking her on. Henry kept one hand on her arm. She wasn't wearing any manacles, another fact what should have struck me as odd, but didn't. As he knocked on the inner office door and Mr. Picton told him to enter, he opened the door and indicated to Libby that she should go on in. He did this by way of a single look, the kind of quick, meaningful glance what only people who know each other very well use to communicate. "Come in, Mrs. Hunter," I heard Mr. Picton call. "Thank you, Henry. I'll send someone down when we're finished." "You don't want me to wait?" the guard asked. Mr. Picton just sighed. "Henry, am I speaking Greek? If I wanted you to wait, I'd ask you to wait. Go back downstairs, and I'll send someone when we're finished. Thank you very much." Looking the way he always did when Mr. Picton gave him a hard time, like some kind of injured animal, the guard glanced at Libby again, and she nodded at him once. Only at that signal did Henry turn around to storm moodily out of the room. As for Libby, she went on in and took a seat before Mr. Picton's desk, next to Mr. Darrow, while Mr. Maxson closed the door on the rest of us. "All right, Stevie," Mr. Moore whispered. "Up you go." In a quick move, I stepped into a cradle what Marcus made with his hands, then grabbed Cyrus's hands and let him pull me onto his shoulders. Once comfortably seated, with Cyrus holding onto my legs, I carefully moved my face up to the transom, which was open just far enough for me to see all the players in the room, along with a swatch of Mr. Picton's desk. Whispering down to the others at regular intervals, I witnessed and narrated the following scene. "Why have I been called up here at this hour?" Libby asked softly and sadly. Her expression, what I could only see in profile, looked much more timid than it had in the outer office. "Is it Clara? Has something happened to my baby?"
"Now, now, Mrs. Hatch," Mr. Maxson said, putting a hand to her arm. "I beg your pardon, Mrs. Hunter. Please calm yourself." "Yes, do spare yourself the effort, Mrs. Hunter," Mr. Picton said, without any trace of sympathy in his voice. "You're not in court now, nor are there any members of the press looking about. Your usual histrionics are not required."
"Instead of being insulting, Picton," Mr. Darrow said, crossing one leg over the other and then leaning back in his chair, "you might tell us what the hell it is you want."
"Yes," Mr. Picton answered, lighting his pipe with quick little moves of his arms and hands. "I don't see that there's any reason to beat around the bush."
Letting out big blasts of smoke, he sat forward.
"The raspberry bush, to be precise, Mrs. Hunter. The one behind your family's barn in Scattercoke."
He opened his eyes a bit wider.
"Or weren't the bushes there when you were still living at home?" "No, I don't suppose they would have been. Too difficult to get under them to do all that digging. Still, they grow like weeds, do raspberries. Quite tall now. They almost hide the thing.
Almost.
Libby's head had frozen, and her hands were clutching tightly at the arms of her chair. I could only see one of the golden eyes, but it had opened wide, wider than I'd ever seen before, wide enough to make me believe that for once she might have been truly surprised and at a loss.
"Picton," Mr. Darrow said, scratching at his head and looking very annoyed, "have you taken complete leave of your senses? Or does all this babbling actually mean something?"
But Mr. Maxson's face revealed a very different kind of reaction. He may not have understood exactly what his opponent was talking about, but he obviously knew that the assistant district attorney didn't spend a lot of time ranting pointlessly about nothing at all.
"Picton," Mr. Maxson said quietly, "do you have new information you plan to introduce?"
Mr. Picton didn't answer either of the questions, just continued to stare at Libby, his gray eyes turning that strange, silvery color they did when he was excited. After a few seconds, he started to nod.
"Yes, Mrs. Hunter, we've found them. Your mother and your brother, Elijah. And, more importantly, we've found it, and heard the whole story."
This last statement contained a bit of a bluff, I knew, but all good lawyers know the value of a calculated bluff. Libby continued to say nothing, causing both of her counsels to turn to her in some concern.
"What's he talking about?" Mr. Darrow said, his deep voice sounding like he too was beginning to suspect that Mr. Picton might have hold of something real.
Libby just kept staring silently at Mr. Picton, but she seemed to sense that he wasn't the real cause of her predicament, and soon the golden eyes moved over to fix on the doctor.
"Who? What in hell are you?"
she near whispered in a voice so icy mean that it seemed to shock both Mr. Maxson and Mr. Darrow. For his part, the doctor just shrugged and stared back at the woman.
"Only a man who knows what you are capable of, Mrs. Hunter. Nothing more."
Growing very uneasy, Mr. Darrow stood up and shoved his hands into his pockets.
"All right, look, is somebody going to tell us what's going on here or not?"
"It's fairly simple, Darrow," Mr. Picton answered, finally looking away from Libby, though horrifying in its simplicity. 10 years ago, I'm afraid I can't give you an exact date, though we suspect it was in the spring, your client bore a child, an illegitimate child. She murdered it and buried the body behind her family's barn in a coffin that also contained the body of her dog, which I'm sure she also killed to provide a cover for the burial. We've seen the gravesite and have corroborating statements from members of her family. We're prepared to discuss a deal."
Mr. Darrow's eyes went wide. "Well, of all the desperate 11th-hour tricks—"
He stopped as Libby silently raised a hand to him.
"And if we don't take your deal?" she asked.
"Then," Mr. Picton replied, smoking again, "we exhume the child's body, making your mother, who is still, by the way, ignorant of our discovery, fully aware of the crime, and arrest you as soon as the current trial is over. We may also arrest your brother as an accessory. He did, after all, build the coffin and dig the grave."
"He knew nothing about it,"
Libby said, without thinking. Moving automatically, Mr. Darrow put a firm hand to his client's shoulder.
"Say absolutely nothing, Mrs. Hunter."
Satisfied that she would obey him, Mr. Darrow turned to Mr. Picton again.
"Are you finished?"
"Yes, just about," Mr. Picton answered. Sitting back down and rubbing his furrowed brow, Mr. Darrow studied Libby's face carefully for what seemed like a long time. There was obviously something there what he didn't like, something what told him that maybe Mr. Picton wasn't talking through his hat.
"Hypothetically speaking," Mr. Darrow said slowly, without turning away from Libby, "what kind of a deal are you talking about?"
"We will reduce the charge in the current case to second-degree murder if she will change her plea to guilty."
"And," the doctor added carefully, "contact her associates in New York tomorrow morning, and instruct them to release the child, Anna Linares, into our custody when we return."
Mr. Picton nodded. "In return, she receives a life sentence without the possibility of parole." Libby seemed like she was about to respond, but Mr. Darrow moved one of his big hands back to her shoulder.
Don't say anything, he told her again, even more firmly this time. Then he glanced over at Mr. Picton. Do you suppose Mr. Maxson and I could discuss this privately with our client? Maybe have some time to think about it.
You can discuss it in this office for the next 15 minutes, Mr. Picton answered. That's how long the deal's good for. The doctor and I will leave you.
Rising, Mr. Picton nodded to the doctor, who slowly followed him toward the door. Not wanting to get caught spying, I quickly slipped off Cyrus's shoulders and jumped to the floor with a bump. When the door opened, I'd just managed to get myself upright again, and as the doctor came out, he gave me a curious look what said he suspected I'd been up to something. When Mr. Picton closed the door, though, all attention turned to other subjects. Well, Mr. Moore said, though I'd already told him and the others where things stood. I guess he figured he ought to observe the formalities.
Well, Mr. Picton echoed quietly in response, I think we've got a very decent chance. She seems to be taking us quite seriously. I don't think she wants to have her mother made aware of what her only daughter's done with her life or dragged into court to testify about an infanticide that took place right under her nose. The possibility of her brother's being prosecuted seemed to strike a nerve, too.
There's no reading the woman, though, the doctor added, considering it. Something in her tone was wrong. She was shocked, certainly, but she doesn't have the manner of someone who feels the trap closing. Not yet.
Maybe what you said is true, then, doctor, Lucius answered. Maybe some part of her unconscious mind is drawn to the idea of prison.
The doctor shook his head quickly, struggling with something. No, there was a different quality. I can't quite define it. And I don't think I'll be able to, not at any rate, he pulled out his watch, for another 14 minutes. Those 14 minutes passed in almost complete silence. The three people in Mr. Picton's office kept their voices very low, making it impossible for us to tell what they were talking about. And as for our group, I think we were all too nervous to speculate any further about what might happen. Both the doctor and Mr. Picton checked their watches every minute or so, always breathing heavily when they found how little time had passed. Finally, though, the moment did come for them to head back into the office. Mr. Picton gave the doctor a little nod of his head, and then he rapped on the door gently. Not waiting for a reply, he headed in, holding the door open for the doctor and then closing it on the rest of us.
"Stevie!"
Mr. Moore whispered, but I'd already gotten halfway up Cyrus's back and was looking through the transom by the time Mr. Picton said, "Well, Darrow, do you have a decision?" Looking at the floor and going through his pockets in a busy but meaningless sort of way, Mr. Darrow said, "I'm afraid you'll have to direct your questions to Mr. Maxson from now on, Picton." Mr. Picton looked surprised. "Oh?" "Yes," Mr. Darrow answered, still not wanting to look either Mr. Picton or the doctor in the face. "Mrs. Hunter has seen fit to dispense with my advice. Such being the case, I intend to return to Chicago by the next available train." Trading what you might call astonished looks, Mr. Picton and the doctor both did their best not to show any obvious signs of relief or gloating.
"Oh, surely not," Mr. Picton said.
"You can spare me the professional courtesy, Picton," Mr. Darrow said. "But if you want to crow, feel free. You've managed to pull off one hell of a stunt." Through all this, Libby Hatch just sat staring straight ahead, with a look on her face what said she'd pretty well had done with Mr. Darrow. As for Mr. Maxson, his usually nervous face showed for the first time a certain sort of relief. "I've got to catch the trolley and get my things," Mr. Darrow went on as he headed for the door. His big shoulders looked more stooped to me than usual, though I could have been imagining it. "There's a midnight train, I think, to Buffalo. I can catch a connection there."
"Well," Mr. Picton said, relighting his pipe, "I am sorry you won't be here."
"Oh, I'm sure you are, Picton," Mr. Darrow said, smiling a bit. Then, before I had a chance to do anything but rap on Cyrus's head, the lawyer grabbed hold of the knob on the door and pulled. Cyrus jumped to the left so that at least the rest of the people in the office wouldn't be able to see us, but when Mr. Darrow came out and closed the door behind him,
he looked up to see me still perched on Cyrus's shoulders. I half expected him to give out with some kind of outraged lecture concerning the ethics of our behavior, so I was very surprised when he just shook his head, causing one of those locks of hair of his to fall forward, and then chuckled in a very friendly fashion.
"I have never seen anything to beat this," he said, saluting our group with two fingers, and then exiting through the outer office door. As soon as he was gone, Cyrus stepped back over to his right, positioning me by the transom again. I carefully peered into the office once more to find that the doctor, Mr. Picton, and Mr. Maxson were all staring at the still silent Libby Hatch.
Mrs. Hunter has decided.